One. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Authority Smashing Hour with your host, Luke Kim, and Mr. 1001 Nights. Join us as we embark on a journey through radical news and politics. Take callers. It gets you ready to engage in the struggle against capitalism.
Hello everyone once again, and welcome to the Authority Smashing Hour, your favorite anarchist show on the internet. And today, Tuesday, with your hosts, Joey and Mr. 1001 Nights. And how you doing, Joey? I understand you have a little bit of a cold there, huh?
Yeah, I think I got a little bit of some sniffles or something. I don't know what's going on, but
yeah.
I'll be all right. I'm fine.
Yeah, that stuff is going around. Well,
yeah.
We do have some news.
For our listeners, the number to call in is 646-716-8106.
That's it. Call anytime you want, and we'll try to answer your queries. Or, you know, you can say whatever you want, and we'll try to discuss it. But we have a few items here that I think are worth discussing. The first is a survey that basically highlights global concerns over, you know, the so-called free market capitalist system that has been in you know, governing our world economic system since the 1970s, the so-called neoliberal period. And it turns out that to mark the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, the BBC released the results of an international poll yesterday that revealed widespread dissatisfaction with free market capitalism around the globe. It says that only 11% of people surveyed across 27 countries thought that free market capitalism is working well. Meanwhile, 23% of respondents across all nations said capitalism is fatally flawed and a new economic system is needed. And about half of the respondents said the problems with capitalism can be solved with more regulation and reform. So, I mean, it clearly shows a trend toward either Keynesian sort of capitalism or socialism or other alternatives, syndicalism, anarchism, stuff like that. How do you interpret that, Joey?
Oh, I think this is very similar to some polls that came out. I think you did a YouTube video about them within the last year, measuring satisfaction with capitalism, and I think it was like outlooks on capitalism and socialism by people around the world. And so these fall in line basically with those exact ones that you put up. And I think when we're thinking about, you know, this, that satisfaction with capitalism, it's sort of a global occurrence. I think, like in Latin America, for instance, more people had a favorable opinion of socialism than they did of capitalism and free market capitalism. So this, you know, pretty much falls right in line with that.
I like that.
With that sentiment. You remember what I'm talking about? The video you put up?
Man, I've done like hundreds of videos. I don't know which one. I'm losing count here. If I remember well, on your profile on Facebook, you put up a Russian proverb that was mentioned by Zizek, that it was something like that they said that the communists lied about everything they said about communism was wrong, but everything they said about capitalism was true, something like that, right?
Yeah.
It was all a lie.
everything the communists told us about communism was a lie, but everything they told us about capitalism was true.
Right.
And that's a proverb. Actually, I got that proverb from Blum, which is somebody that you and David were talking about yesterday. So it's one of those, you know, it's one of those late Russian, late 90s, you know, Russian proverbs that sort of diagnose the predicament that they found themselves in after, you know, after the fall of communism.
Apparently, you know, I've read a little bit about that era in Russia, and it was similar to Stalin's purges. It was so bad. It's like you had you had over 1 million people that died just from the conditions of the new capitalist free market measures that were being incorporated into the system. It was an awful, awful period. And I mean, I'm not saying it's any good in Russia now, but that period was apparently so awful that people realized very quickly that they didn't want to do that. And in fact, all those former client states of the Soviet Union, in Eastern Europe, they very quickly became sort of the new sweatshop regions now for American
Definitely.
and multinational corporations. So now, if you go, I remember a few years ago that I was going out on a date with this girl, and we went, and she's like, "Hey, I want to go buy some clothing," you know. So we went to one of these stores, you know. It was like a Gap type store, and so I, while she was browsing around, I was looking at the tags, right, and it said, you know, China, you know, Vietnam, Bangladesh, and then I saw, I forget what the country was. It was, you know, Bulgaria, or those eastern countries sort of have become a new source of cheap labor, and
Right.
so it's
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting to keep in mind exactly what the fallout was from the fall of communism, because, and this is something the Zizek article that you and David touched on yesterday speaks to, and that is that the sort of totalitarian regime in place during, you know, quote unquote communism in Eastern Europe and Russia, was far, far better suited to exploit, you know, the quote unquote freedom of capitalism than the supposed people that capitalism is supposed to let free, make free, etc. And so what you had was, you know, the same exact tyrants, essentially totalitarians, that ran the economy under the state, basically took over, you know. And this
Right,
is where
and
Putin and his friends, you know, descend from, and you know, it gives rise, especially with the you know, with the transition from the KGB, it gives rise to like the Russian mafia and the other oligarchs.
we can learn a lot about the old system by seeing who's at the top in the new system, and it turns out that all the old party hacks from the old system became the new wealthy capitalists. They all quickly became millionaires, and that's another interesting thing. We were actually talking about the Zizek article yesterday, and I don't quite agree with everything he said, because I don't think that he was sort of. It seemed to me that he was saying that capitalism inherently it leads to these sort of liberal cultural environments, but I don't think that's true. I think that the authoritarian social environment is the natural thing for capitalism, and only after people struggle and do they get to get some of the more you know, free you know, some of the freedoms that we have in our society. So, but yeah, China is the perfect example of that. I mean, China, obviously, you know, it has a sort of a corporate market economy right now, corporate capitalist economy, and it's, you know, very authoritarian. In fact, I just read that I think it was nine people that were just executed in China. Which it says, okay, let me, I have it right here. Nine people have been executed for taking part in protests and riots in the Xinjiang region in July. It is believed that most, if not all, of the executed were Uyghurs, a predominantly Muslim ethnic group that live in Western China. It says in July, nearly 200 people were killed during unrest between. So, I mean, you have a lot of you have incredible exploitation. So you have a trim, and so it's obvious that all the sort of farce that we've been seeing these last few days about the Berlin Wall and the evil commies and stuff is pure hypocrisy, because they don't care about suffering and oppression so long as it fills their own pockets.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think I need to track down where I got the communism quote from.
It was that.
But it is sort of instructive if we go back to like you know, early 90s Soviet Russian history, and see how they got to the authoritarian capitalism that Zizek's talking about in that article. I think Zizek is under no delusion that, you know, capitalism really is this beacon of freedom. I mean, getting back to that article, I think that's what he's sort of saying that it's billed as, it's sold as, and he's under no simplistic, you know, delusion that it is. But yeah, I mean, if we go back to like Russian history right after the fall of communism, what they ended up doing, and this is why it was so easy for them to transition over to the oligarchy they've got now, and that is that the state, when it dissolved communism, handed out basically vouchers, okay, to each individual citizen, okay? And these vouchers were supposed to be, that individual citizen's ownership, private ownership to X factory or farm or whatever, okay? So that these vouchers, and stop me if you're not familiar with it or whatever, but and these vouchers ended up being like a currency in lots of ways, and people would trade these vouchers with one another for like basic types of goods. I mean, we're talking about the collapse of an economy. So the state's response, okay, which was to privatize these industries, okay, and agriculture, was to give each individual citizen their private part, okay, as personified in these vouchers. So what would happen is these oligarchs, these, you know, Communist Party apparatchik, KGB people who had access to cash, et cetera, and durable goods and other goods, were able to get these vouchers from the regular Russian people for dirt-ass cheap, okay? And so they were able to consolidate their control over these industries into their own private hands. And basically, for all intents and purposes, they were able to use the economic and social upheaval of the fall of communism to basically rob lots of the Russian people of these vouchers, okay? And then once they consolidated a bunch of these vouchers, these people became massively rich because they took control of the oil industry, the manufacturing industries, the agriculture, et cetera, in Russia. And that's the situation that Russia finds itself in right now. Now, in Eastern Europe and the other countries, it wasn't quite as bad, but it was still a very similar thing when they moved over and transitioned over to privatization. And the voucher program is very interesting because it was a program that was promoted by the U.S. and U.S. business interests. And so that's the background to, you know, the sort of fall of communism, oh, isn't it wonderful, isn't it great, that you found, you know, this past week leading up to the fall of the Berlin Wall yesterday, the anniversary of it, the 20-year anniversary of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, we actually spoke about the Berlin Wall yesterday and all the events that led to it, which had been distorted by the media. Like we mentioned, for example, how there had been a lot of attacks and sabotage by the United States and other Western countries, and how the and how a lot of the government trained workers in East Germany were sort of taken by West Germany, and how, you know, because before they were traveling back and forth, and that led to a sort of a crisis of labor in East Germany. So there were a lot of factors that led to the creation of that wall, which are not talked about in the media. But anyway, since we already talked about that, perhaps we can move on to another issue here, and that is that there was another news item. So a whistleblower has said that peak oil is closer than IEA forecast shows. This an anonymous whistleblower at the International Energy Agency has told the Guardian newspaper that the world is much closer running out of oil than official estimates admit. The whistleblower, described as a senior official at the agency, accused the United States of playing an influential role in encouraging the watchdog to underplay the rate of decline from existing oil fields while overplaying the chances of finding new reserves. So, I mean, that's that, you know, that right there, that that should be you know, front page art, you know, news all over the place as well, but we're not hearing about it very much. But you know what's going to happen? What's going to happen when we run out of oil? What's going to happen when we destroy the environment? Surprisingly, I heard a news it was a news item. It was trying to say that some of the byproducts of global warming may actually be good. You know, so there's an incredible industry out there to. To, you know, they're saying, yeah, you know, we'll have nice warm, you know, we'll have summer all year round, you know, hey, let's go to the beach, you know, let's drink some champagne on the beach or whatever. But, you know, that's basically what you're getting, and totally underestimating the destructive potential of the things that we're doing.
So it's wow.
But yeah, I mean, without oil, just think about everyone's cars, everything, plastics. I mean, I actually covered that in my documentary where I talk about how the actual technological change, the machine age that we saw in the 20th century, you know, in the sort of shift from coal to oil from the 19th to the 20th century, that was primarily due to oil. Every machine needs oil, just as, you know, for lubricants, for all kinds of different functions. So, you know, without oil, it's gonna be, you know, we're gonna need massive changes. So, that's something to worry about.
I was watching something that. Let's see, the Stimulator put up, he had an interview with Tim Jensen. And Tim Jensen's, you know, this huge, like, anti-civ person, et cetera.
Right.
But he was making a good point. I'm not going to fly as far as that as that bird. But he made a good point that, you know, when we think about civilization and when we think about, you know, the ages that our technology has gone through, bronze, iron, et cetera, we're at a point now where we consume so much of the Earth's resources, okay? And the idea is, of course, to make every country, at least this is what the idealists want to convey, to make every country like the U.S., you know, a nice consumer economy where, you know, people have all these nice goods, et cetera, et cetera. The problem, of course, is the fact that, you know, these resources are not endless, you know.
Right. I mean, but the assumption is that
the civilization that we've built is not sustainable in this measure.
How do you address the argument that with advances in technology, we'll be able to use something to derive infinite energy from a limited amount of resources, that we can extract so much, you know, energy out of basically nothing, out of rocks, you know? Do you think there's any strength to that argument?
I think you know, we can get better at extracting energy, but at some point, if we don't change our approach, then we will inevitably run out. I mean, you know, these things aren't.
I think it should be sort of a mandatory trip for every school kid out there to go to a landfill every month. Every month they should have a school trip to a huge landfill like around the country, so that the kids see the amount of trash that is created. You know, wouldn't that be something worthy, of course.
I think we should put, like, rich people, and instead of them taking cruises on these massive, you know, luxurious cruise liners, they should get on. They should take cruises on garbage barges, and they could build little shanty towns on these garbage barges that basically float around the entire planet, looking for a place to dump their crap. And, you know, usually it ends up outside of a small third world developing country, like, oh, I don't know, Somalia, where they dump their garbage in the water. But yeah, that's what I think the rich people should do with their cruises.
Right,
with their tongue cruising around.
It's easier to ignore that and just point at those evil pirates, right, in Somalia who are not happy when our crap and we overfish their waters. How dare they?
Exactly.
How dare they?
Yeah,
exactly. It's really messed up. Well, I guess on different news here, the Afghanistan problem is CBS just announced that Obama is going to send about 40,000 troops to Afghanistan. And he's trying actually to get more NATO troops as well to go there. He's trying to get a further 4,000 troops from other countries. I mean, because we know when we talk about NATO, we talk primarily about the United States. So all these other countries, you know, they send a few thousand troops, maybe a few hundred troops, but the U.S. is the main player. So, but he's asking them as well. So it's, I mean, it's just not looking so well. This public option, apparently something passed, but it says, I read that the Congress is going to miss the healthcare deadline that they had. So it's a pretty tough battle still. And on the other, so I mean, it's just every sort of subject, every major decision of the Obama administration is full of compromises, and it's very hard to see, any of the sort of promises of the electoral campaign coming true. You know, it's, all of it is sort of dissolving into nothingness. And
yeah, I was keeping up with the whole Afghanistan troop thing, and what's interesting is that lots of people are conjecturing on the left and the right that Obama was close to sort of losing his generals in the sense of like losing their support, et cetera, et cetera. If he had decided to actually draw down troops in Afghanistan or approach, use some other strategy other than, you know, a John McCain style troop surge, you know? And so I think this is like one of his, you know, efforts. I mean, he is after all just a politician. To try to balance himself, you know, and make sure that he throws everybody a bone, because of course the military cares very mightily about its war machine at this point, and especially all the defense contractors and all the defense industry as well. So there's got to be some war happening somewhere. I mean, you know.
You know, and also did you hear about?
You can't just sit around idle.
Because Obama had talked about closing Guantanamo, and apparently it hasn't been closed. And it says, a year after Obama's election win, Al Jazeera has learned that despite the new president's pledge to close the prison and improve the conditions of detainees, prisoners believe that their treatment has deteriorated on his watch. And, I mean, they've done things like they took away group recreation for prisoners in segregation. They took away books. They sprayed pepper spray into cells, is saying that, they're saying it's worse, being humiliated, you know, beaten. I mean, all the stuff we heard about before, and apparently still happening, and in some ways worse. So, I mean, it's just like all these promises, sort of like when are people going to learn that they've been betrayed, and that, you know, it's... It's just
it's even bigger than that. I mean, as long as we have the war on terror, you know, it's inevitable that, there's going to have to be terrorists housed somewhere, in prison somewhere. Okay, it's got to be somewhere. So even if he does manage to somehow close down Guantanamo, it doesn't mean they're not going to be stuck somewhere else without trial, without without law, without judges, et cetera, et cetera. And so, I mean, you know, it's like the Guantanamo thing is one of those, like, you know, symbolic sops that a politician throws to like liberals to make them feel better about their complicity in the system. That's all Guantanamo is in the grand scheme of things.
I
was reading elsewhere. I think it was an article linked to from GNN.TV, which is a fun little news service. But yeah, I think that they linked to something about like us building like this massive friggin' military prison installation somewhere in the Middle East where lots of these guys would end up anyways. So, I mean, to me, it's just it's a dog and pony show, and
right. But I think that it's sort of like, you know, when in the 80s, the Reagan administration was forced to go underground because of it knew that if it came out openly, you know, telling everyone what they were really doing, that there would be massive public opposition to you know, the Contras, the Contra activities and all that stuff. So they had to go underground. So I think that if they close Guantanamo, that's a sort of that's a step in that direction of going underground and not because, I mean, the Guantanamo's out in the open. But notice that we haven't heard much about that.
It could very well be, but I mean, you're assuming that there isn't a bunch of stuff going on underground also right now anyway.
So. Right. No, I mean, well, there is. I mean, you know, the CIA has secret prisons all around the world. And in fact, I mean, just recently, I think I talked about it a few shows ago that it was the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan who was talking about how Bush was sending all these detainees to Uzbekistan and they were being, you know, killed and tortured and people boiled alive and all kinds of imaginable torture. So it's pretty messed up. And so
A heads up for our listeners. Again, thanks for listening. And our number is to call in 646-716-8106, 646-716-8106. And we'll be taking a break here in the next, you know, 5 minutes or so.
Yeah, well, so I guess we can just go ahead.
Or comments or whatever, you know, call in and we can talk it out.
So we can play, what do you want to play, Joey?
Well, how about we do Muse's Uprising?
We can do that. We played it a few times. We can play it again. I guess to end, we can play some of the new songs that Dave has uploaded. But let's play Muse Uprising.
Oh, yeah. We'll do that at the end. We'll do a rage song at the end.
All right.
We'll be right back.
was Uprising by Muse. Welcome to the Authority Smashing Hour, your favorite anarchist show on the internet. And if you want to call in, the guest call-in number is 646-716-8106. So we're back for the second half of the show. And I guess we're going to talk a little bit about something that just happened the so-called Democrat Joe Lieberman, he was on Fox News, and he said that, I'm quoting him, the motives of, he's talking about the Fort Hood massacre, where about 13 people were killed, 13 soldiers. He says, the motives of Nidal Hassan in carrying out this brutal mass murder, if a terrorist attack, the worst terrorist attack since 9/11. So here's the thing, that he killed soldiers. Right, he was killing soldiers. It was clearly an attack on a military, and that sort of reveals a very pervasive ideology, and that we've seen from the very beginning. Like when you had people in Afghanistan fighting against U.S. soldiers that were invading their own country illegally, they became terrorists. So even fighting to defend your own country, fighting against an army, that makes you into a terrorist. I mean, that's amazing. So therefore, you're not entitled to, of course, if you're captured, you're not a prisoner of war. You're what is called an enemy combatant. I mean, the double standards here are so blatant. Yet, you know, we don't hear any of that. What do you?
Yeah, I find that to be a comedy of high order. When the event first happened, I was like, whatever. I mean, not whatever, like, oh, people lost their lives, I don't care about that. But, like, as far as, like, the political significance of it, like, I didn't find the event to be all that politically significant at all. I mean, I figured when it first happened, I was like, okay, it's either some, you know, kook going postal, you know, or it's some, you know, Islamic guy going in there and making an attack. And either way, it was going to be sort of, you know, integrated into already existing dominant, you know, dominant categories. So it just happened that the guy was Islamic, and, you know, Nidal Hassan, you know, it survived. So that'll be interesting. I guess we'll have a nice little trial and whatnot, and everybody will be, you know, feel good when they send the guy to jail and, you know, whatever, like they did with Timothy McVeigh. But yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous, especially when we consider that, you know, many historians would think of terrorist tactics as basically guerrilla war tactics. And like modern guerrilla tactics were invented, you know, in America during the American Revolutionary War, when we had terrorists like Francis Marion, the Swamp Fox, you know, chasing around British columns.
I thought that they were the word guerrilla comes from the Spanish in the.
It does. I'm talking about, like, historically speaking, like they trace those types of tactics.
Right. No. Yeah. Because in the
Revolutionary War,
when Napoleon invaded Spain, when Napoleon invaded Spain, they used similar tactics as well.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's sort of like it's a sort of instinctive tactic that you use against a bigger army that you can't confront face to face, because and it's funny that they always actually portray that as cowardly. They're saying, if you don't you know, face us face to face and get crushed, then you're a coward. I mean, it's incredible.
Oh,
it's,
yeah.
Like, yeah, what about the cowardice of you know, trying to overwhelmingly crush someone with you know, $1 trillion equipment, you know? But you know, going back to
what about the cowardliness of, like, crushing somebody's economy from, you know, thousands upon thousands of miles away just by recalling a debt? It goes on and on. I mean, yeah, what's cowardly? You know, Nidal Hassan walking into a place with a couple of pistols, John Woo style, and going crazy on people, or, you know, the U.S. government dropping tons and tons and tons of bombs from the stratosphere. Okay, right. On people that are lucky to have a rifle.
It's just incredible. But if we actually go back to the semantics of terror, what we were talking about before about this use of the word. We actually may. I think one of the best texts written on it is Chomsky and Herman's "The Washington Connection and Third World Fascism," which was actually written in 1979, which would make it 30 years this year. And if I may read an excerpt here, it says, "Among the many symbols used to threaten and manipulate the populace of the democratic states, few have been more important than terror and terrorism. These terms have generally been confined to the use of violence by individuals and marginal groups. Official violence, which is far more extensive in both scale and destructiveness, is placed in a different category altogether. This usage has nothing to do with justice, causal sequence, or numbers abused. Whatever the actual sequence of cause and effect, official violence is described as responsive or provoked, like retaliation, protective reaction, etc., not as the active and initiating source of abuse. Similarly, the massive long-term violence inherent in the oppressive social structures that U.S. power has supported or imposed is typically disregarded. The numbers tormented and killed by official violence, wholesale as opposed to retail terror, during recent decades, have exceeded those of unofficial terrorists by a factor running into the thousands. But this is not terror." It's amazing that 30 years ago these guys were already talking about all this stuff, and it's just it could be applied perfectly well to everything that's happening today.
Sure. I mean, this is it's 30 years old. I mean, it's obviously sort of nothing new. It just happens to be happening as usual. On schedule, typically right now. So, it's not surprising to me. I don't know how much to sort of get up arms about it, about these specific types of things. But it's amusing. On a related note to Chomsky's thing, the Chomsky thing you just read. He, of course, has written a bunch about Latin America as well. Recently, Hugo Chavez has come out and basically, told Colombia and the U.S., fuck off. Don't be surprised that there's going to be a war if you, install a bunch of U.S. military bases, advisors, et cetera, in Colombia under the auspices of looking for, drug lords, the same thing is still happening in even closer to home in Latin America itself. So this is going on, and we have, Hugo Chavez now who's, getting set to stand up against it. Possibly, I don't know, if it's bluster or what, but there you have it. I mean, it's the empire just rolls on and does its thing. And
right, and in that vein, we could actually talk about this new shift toward right wing populism, which we've seen, and which of course is part of the attempt to justify and legitimize all these oppressive structures, not only domestically but also internationally, with false stories, scapegoats, et cetera, et cetera. So if you want, we can play a clip by Chomsky where he actually talks about this. So let me see. Okay, here's Chomsky on right-wing populist movements.
Like right now, there is a right-wing populist uprising. The town hall meetings, the demonstrations and so on. That's very common, even on the left, which is ridiculous. These lunatics talking about Obama the socialist, the communist, and the fascist, and death panels, and all the rest of it. But that's not the right reaction. If you look at these people and you listen to them on talk radio, those are people with real grievances. I listen to talk radio a lot. It's kind of interesting. And it's insane, but it's interesting. And if you can sort of suspend your knowledge of the world and just sort of try to enter into the world of the people who are calling in, you can understand it. I mean, I've never seen a study. My sense of it is that these are people who feel really aggrieved. I've done everything right all my life. I'm a God-fearing Christian. I'm white. I'm male. I've worked hard. You know, I carry a gun. I do everything I'm supposed to do. And I'm getting shafted. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they are getting shafted. You know, for 30 years, their wages have stagnated or declined. The social conditions have worsened. The children are going crazy. There's no schools. There's nothing. So what's somebody's doing something to me? Who is it? Well, you know, Rush Limbaugh has an answer. It's the rich liberals who own the banks and run the government and, of course, run the media, and they don't care about you. There's a name for them. You're the flyby people. You don't live in Boston, New York, and you're not in San Francisco, or it's run by gays. You're the other people, you know, the kind of hardworking, honest Americans. And they don't care about you, these guys who own the corporations and the banks. They just want to give everything away to illegal immigrants and you know, gays and communists and so on. And we got to defend ourselves against them. And everything they tell you is just a way to suppress you. Like they talk about this thing they made up called global warming because they want to take away your jobs. And they talk about health reform because they want to, you know, put a microchip in you and make sure the government runs you. And it goes on like that. Well, you know, the reaction we should be having to them is not ridicule, but rather self-criticism. Why aren't we organizing? I mean, we're the ones who ought to be organizing, not Rush Limbaugh. And if they're caught up in this, well, it's our fault. And there are historical analogs, which are not exact, of course, but are close enough to be worrisome. This has and so take right now. There is a right wing.
So yeah, that was Chomsky on right-wing populism. And sorry for listeners if the clip was too low, because you know, Chomsky sometimes speaks very low, and we didn't upload the clip with a higher volume, which we should have. But you know, that sort of reminds me to, you know, the documentary that I did, Golden Rule, because the first part of it was sort of meant to address that, and I was trying to actually address two sort of groups at the same time. One is this right-wing populist movement, you know, the tea baggers and all these people, and the other were the so-called free market capitalist libertarians, which are which were also sort of part of these teabag protests. And I mean, the point is that instead of looking at where the real power is and the real sort of influence in our society, that you know, where their most of their grievances should be directed to, they are once again being directed by those same people towards scapegoats. So they are being victims of the same people who they think they're fighting against. So it's a very frustrating thing to see. Because, in fact, what I try to highlight in my documentary is that these people hate, you know, they say, oh, you know, we hate the government, we all these. But on the other hand, what do they hate about government? They've been manipulated into favoring military intervention. I'm talking about the right, sort of the right wing, military intervention. And you know, and then being against any sort of democratic use of the government. So you know, you can't push for universal health care because that's oppression, that's socialism. But if you spend $1 trillion on war, that's okay. I mean, sort of they have these double standards, and they've been so clearly manipulated. And then unions, for them, unions are just corrupt organizations that are illegitimate. And you know, they don't understand that all that's going, you know, most of what they're going through is basically something that's been prepackaged for them by business propaganda. And I mean,
yeah, I think it's very important to try to figure out how to talk to you know, right wing populism. And I posted a link in the chat room to a fun little article that came out, I think, the Institute of Anarchist Studies, called "Of Tea Parties and Patriots," something like that. And it's a good article, like basically outlining approaches for left radicals to take or to think about when. You know, when they have to deal with sort of strain of right-wing populism, because it is important for us to be able to talk to these people, because otherwise, you know, we're going to be lost, because they'll win. I mean, like you and Dave were talking about yesterday, there's two ways people can go when things get bad. They can go the fascist way or the good way, and our job is, of course, to steer them away from those fascist tendencies. I mean, you know.
Right.
I put that article in the chat room because it speaks to that issue of like how do we talk to them.
I may say that I mentioned a second group, the free market capitalists, and they're slightly different in that they don't support the military interventions of the U.S. government. So they're not exactly the same as the other ones, but I wanted to address them too because I've had so many debates with them on YouTube. Basically, they oppose any sort of democratization of the state, and they say, well, you know, let's just you know, I oppose the government, but actually by negating the possibility of you know, democratizing existing institutions, you're just cutting your own throat, because we're not in a position of strength. We're extremely weak. So right now, I think a sensible strategy, which must be respected, is to try to push democracy to whatever extent we can within the current institutions, while, you know, giving space and building on you know, new institutions. And, you know, a point that's been made over and over again is that if people have universal healthcare, for example, then they can, if they're fired from their job, there's one less thing they fear losing, because now, you know, they lose their salary, but they don't lose their health care. So I mean, it's sort of like, and it gives you more bargaining power as a worker as well, to have to democratize the state, to make it more social democratic, and that doesn't mean that people are not in the future going to see the inherent limitations of our government system vis-a-vis democracy, because obviously it is overall a government is a system whereby a minority controls a majority, where the elite system must be regulated, and that is precisely what gives the public the chance to push for democratic reform, you know, because it's about the government is trying to have a stable system that and accommodate to the needs of the different blocks of investors that control the system.
Well, I think I don't know. I think that there's a lot to be said for the sort of critique that underlies what you're talking about. I think that it also there's a lot of deficiencies in, you know, mainstream left socialist class war type of critique. And that is that I just don't know that it speaks to people very much anymore. And I don't know that that's necessarily a fault of us and rhetoric, a fault of history, or what. But I think that, you know, the old left sort of terminologies revolving around class war, you know, labor exploitation, et cetera, just don't really carry much weight with people nowadays. And I think that, you know, that's one of the reasons why, of course, right-wing populism is so quick to take hold in the U.S., And elsewhere, for that matter. I think, you know, if we look at movements in other places of the world, I think you know, the discourse of class war, et cetera, is more developed, and has developed along more different and more interesting lines than it has in the U.S. and probably in England as well. I don't know how useful it is anymore to talk to a normal right winger in terms of, you know, in basic sort of, you know, 19th century style class war type of terminology.
Right, you got to use terminology.
It just seems very limited to me.
I think that's why that if you actually read the book Manufacturing Consent, they don't use terms like bourgeois, the sort of Marxist terms that we all know what they mean, but they use terms like elite, you know, and they don't use those old terms because people immediately, the moment they hear those terms, they immediately think, well, you're biased, I shouldn't listen to you. But if you explain to them things in terms they can understand, then there's the positive, and you're basically saying the same thing. So instead of saying, I mean, it's funny because take that term bourgeoisie, right? There's actually not an exact word you can use because the bourgeoisie, it can mean the elite, but it can also mean sort of like the upper middle class, right? Sort of like the merchant class, which doesn't, like the small businesses are part of the bourgeoisie, right? Yet they are not the elite. So there doesn't seem to be a term you can actually use that is equivalent to bourgeoisie. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that especially in the U.S., the class situation has become extremely muddled. And I'll give you an example of this. Virtually everybody is invested in the stock market, okay? Virtually everybody has a 401k. Wherein, you know, some of the surplus value of their labor, i.e. whatever, you know, extra profit sharing, blah, 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 the corporation throws these normal people the bone, okay, these normal middle-class people a bone, goes in, okay, to matching 401k plans, all right? Now, what does this do? What this basically does is, in lots of ways, makes everybody complicit and dependent upon the exploitation of the capitalist system. So that, for instance, it is in a worker's best interest after they retire, okay, for the company they just retired from to be downsized in order to maximize its profits. Okay, so this is what I'm talking about. Like, the class situation has become so completely muddled and convoluted that it's very hard to disentangle everybody's complicities in the system. But that said, that does not alleviate the system from its fundamental exploitative nature. All it does is it implicates us far more deeply, okay, in each other's exploitation. At which point, again, like I said, the normal sort of discourse of class war, the old left sort of terminology of all these things, really doesn't quite fit as well as it can. In order to mobilize people, and especially to get them to sort of think about, you know, different systems that will be less coercive, less controlling, etc.
I think if you actually look at stock ownership, it's extremely concentrated. So the amount of stock and that workers have, say like a General Motors worker or whatever, is minuscule as compared to the. I mean, it's sort of like it's another sort of.
Oh well, I wasn't saying that to imply that somehow these workers had some sort of control over these companies. They don't, of course, because, like you said, the actual workers' proportion of stock ownership is minuscule compared to the huge, you know, corporate owners. But that being said, the corporate owners have essentially opened the door, let these people in to their world, okay, yeah, of exploitation, okay. And at which point it's very difficult for us to promote our ideas using the sort of stock and trade Marxist leftist terminologies, no matter how you dress it up, because, you know, when we think about a corporation, we think about corporate exploitation, et cetera, Chomsky can say elites. We can use the words elites. But, okay, yeah, the elites that run the corporations, well, they're running the corporations, and, oh, my gosh, you know, my mom's a stockholder, other people's parents are stockholders. So these elites are doing what they have to do to increase the value of the stock, et cetera, and this has a cascading effect in everybody's sort of complicity and implication in the system itself. So, I mean, I think that capitalism is extremely durable, extremely sly, and, you know, it is very, just almost like a blob, okay? Like, you can smash it in one spot, and it has no effect. It just sort of absorbs you and whatever. So I think that, you know, there have to be different sorts of ways to illuminate the control and the exploitation that is inherent in the class system, in capitalism, outside of the discourse, the usual types of discourse of class war. Because I don't see how those discourses have benefited, okay, our side in the past, I don't know, 60, 80 years. It's a long time, especially in the U.S.
Yeah, I think we're going to throw some salt to that blob, man. No, and we already have to some extent, because obviously, you know, there has been some improvement in some areas, even though apparently the externalities of the system are destroying the environment. But we do have some weapons at our disposal. And so we should just keep pushing and trying to make these issues clear to the general population. And so if you guys have any right wing friends, maybe you should introduce some of these ideas that you've heard about, and maybe change their mind. So we're about 2 minutes before we end the show, and I want to thank everyone for listening, and thank you as well, Joey.
Yeah, thanks for listening, y'all, and yeah. Hope it was. I hope it's as good as for you as it was for me.
And so I guess we can end up with a song. Dave had uploaded some new song. So we're going to play In My Eyes by Rage Against the Machine. And I'll see you tomorrow at the same time. All right. Good night, everyone.
Good night.